Hello and welcome to the podcast series on laboratories of differentiated integration in a post-Brexit Europe. This podcast series is brought to you by the Sean Monnet Center of Excellence at the University of Agder in Norway. Throughout the series, we will explore different topics related to an increasingly dynamic European Union and bring in experts to share their insight on the European Union. I'm your host, Johan Andersen, and I would like to welcome our two guests for today's episode titled AI and the EU, Troubling Times Ahead, or An Age of Opportunity. With us today, we have the privilege of having two very special guests joining us. Our first guest is Stefan Smager. He is a PhD research fellow in information systems at the University of Agder here in Norway. He holds a BA in information designs from Stuttgart Media University and a Master of Science in Interaction Design from Tallinn University and the Cyprus University of Technology. He has experience as an interaction and user experience designer in various agencies, academic research projects, startups, and international software companies. Inspired by his professional background in developing on different AI products, his research is focused on the interplay between humans and AI, that is, its shortcomings and its possibilities. Stefan Smager has published on different aspects of the human use of AI, namely guidelines for developing a responsible and trustworthy AI, citizens' attitudes towards AI, as well as how AI can be adopted into the public services. Our second guest today is Frans of Malmborg. He is also a PhD research fellow, but in political science and management at the University of Agder. He holds a master in social work from Malmö University, as well as a master in public administration from Gothenburg University. His research is focused on artificial intelligence policy development within an EU context and in the context of the Nordic countries. Drawing on institutional perspectives, he studies the factors that influence policy developments on AI and how these are implemented by both national as well as transnational actors. The overall ambition of his research is to understand and conceptualize political and organizational processes related to current AI developments and how these, through public policy, affect political and government institutions. Finally, before giving the floor or the microphone to our guests, it's important to say that all statements are made in a personal capacity and are the viewpoints of our guests and not their organizations. So let us start off by maybe touching on AI and why the two of you believe it's such a compelling case. We'll cover here both an academic viewpoint, but also a viewpoint from the industry. And we can start with Frans of Malmborg.
Thanks a lot, Johan, for inviting me here. It's good to be here together with you guys. Why is it a compelling case? I mean, there's a lot of takes today. Almost you feel like AI is such a complex technology. AI is such a complex technology, and it goes so fast. The development of the technology at the moment is exponential, which means that it goes increasingly faster by, you know, time. And the reason for me why it's compelling is basically because we're in this sort of transformation and we don't know yet the outcome of it. And we have different people in society trying to grapple with this. I'm focusing on, you know, policymakers, how they are trying to grapple with this phenomena. But everyone has their own take on this. And we don't know the outcome. It's an uncertain sort of development. And that's what I feel is compelling, in a sense. It says something about how we as humans sort of make sense of technology, how we sort of imagine our societies, and there's some large questions, some large issues at stake here, which I think is very, very important to to put a light on and try to understand and try to conceptualize, you know, generally. But then I'm focusing more on the political aspects, the policy aspects of it. Mm. But, well, that's, I guess, what I would say.
Yes, and Stefan Smarker, do you want to chip in?
Sure. So, yeah, first of all, also, thanks for the invitation. It's great to have this conversation. Well, I can mainly just second what Franz has basically just said. I think AI has become such an important part of our daily lives already. And as you said, it's very hard to follow the news on it. You have breakthroughs happening basically on a daily basis. And I think what makes it probably interesting or at least very relevant is kind of the urgency or like the sense of urgency that you get. Mm. Because what was a dystopian scenario maybe a couple of days ago or years ago seems to be like either already happening or very close to happening. So I think if the time to act on it or like to have these conversations, it's would probably have been better yesterday, but it's rather better to have them today than tomorrow.
Mm. All right, let me follow up with a provocative question. So first of all, the obvious for our listeners, what is AI, your definitions and understanding of it, but more so, is it just a technological fad or is it something that we should take serious? And you sort of touched a little bit upon that, so can you elaborate further on?
Yeah, sure. I think it's very hard to say actually at the moment. There still is no like ultimate definition of AI. What is the AI? What defines artificial intelligence? Different people, different scholars have different understandings. I guess if you want to break it down, it's basically kind of, it comes down to this like autonomous character of technology doing things on its own. So, and again, the question about, is it just like kind of like a hype topic at the moment? Because you had that in the past, right? You have heard about things like the AI winters being kind of like periods when no breakthroughs happened. And I had heard colleagues who were working in the AI area saying, well, the next AI winter is about to come. But I don't think that's currently what we are seeing in the news and like with the technology advancement that we see. So no, I think we should definitely pay close attention to it.
So we're in the AI summer right now.
We are.
Heat wave even.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I agree. I mean, it's, but then it's also hard to know. I mean, some people said, yeah, it's a hype, it's a fad, it will blow over, but we're not sure. I think we're in the spring or in the summer. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Like, so it's, it can be like, okay, we're in the summer, and then you know this will go on for a while, and then perhaps people will lose interest. Mm. Or we're in the spring, then this means that we're in the beginning of, you know, just in the beginning, and that's, you know, we don't know yet. Mm. Yet, it's the same as, yeah, are we in the beginning or in the end of a recession, like with the interest rates and all that, like the banks always sort of they change their sort of predictions of this, and at the same time it's this is one of these things that's hard to predict in what, you know, part of the cycle or in what, you know, we are. So that's, yeah, but I agree with Stefan. I think that the spring or the summer. I mean, I think we will see a lot more of this, and it's not just something that will fade away easily.
Yeah, and just maybe to add on this, I guess one of the major differences this time is, and I'm sure we will touch on this later, is all of a sudden this technology has been put into the hand of the public, right? There's not just research laboratories or companies working on it. Well, they are. But now it's also made available.
Yeah.
And it's quite a debatable point. Mm. Is it a good or a bad thing? So yeah. I guess we will definitely come to this, but it's a major difference right now.
Yeah.
So following up on that, given that AI has become sort of a common tool for everyone to use for their benefit or whatever they use it for, is it fairly portrayed in the media? Can you detect as experts a hype that's not warranted in some regards? Like, again, with ChatGPT, I think is the most famous example by now, that it's also being maybe lifted up to something that it's not that now the narrative is that it's some kind of supercomputer that will we will touch upon this later, but that will disrupt our whole society one way or another. Should we be worried about AI, or should we embrace it? Stefan, you can start from the more industry viewpoint, and then we'll touch on the academic viewpoint.
Sure. So, well, I guess in general, I would say a certain level of skepticism and worry is never wrong when it comes to technology. So I think that's probably a good starting point. But especially following the news and seeing kind of that the prominent people are leaving their positions and starting to speak out. We have like the latest example with Geoffrey Hinton, one of the godfathers of AI. I'm not sure if he would call himself that, but with his team, has kind of like invented and developed different mechanisms and models that are basically the backbone of current AI technology. And he just recently left the research part of Google and saying, well, this is going too fast. We don't understand anymore what is happening. We don't have any security guardrails in place. And just following this, I guess there might be a slight time for concern, I guess. Yeah. Don't want to sound overly dramatic here, but... Mm.
And how is it in academia then? Because that's also a hot potato right now.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are concerned. They're right to be concerned. Then again, I think that, but you also said that, yeah, it's being sort of portrayed wrongly in some sense. I could say that there's a lot of talk about, I think that a lot of people talk about these fears, the opportunities and this and that. I think that we need a more sort of pragmatic way of looking at it, that so what are the type of institutions that we want? We have ChatGPT is disrupting universities at the moment. Then we have to look at what type of universities do we want, and how can we use AI to sort of work with us on that. Because now there's a lot of talk about, is it intelligent? Is it not intelligent? Will, the supercomputers or the general AI take over the world? There's a lot of concern about these futuristic scenarios, while there's too little concern, I would say, for the here and now. What can we do about it? Mm-hmm. Right. So in that sense, I think that and there in the scholarly community, there are, of course, like in every other community, there are those who are really, really optimistic about this technology and those who are a bit more pessimistic about it, right? And so and there are emerging streams of literature on both these fronts within the sort of social sciences, right? But I think that a discussion is definitely, the discussion is definitely needed here. Mm.
So can you name, just for our listeners' sake, some good and bad uses for AI? Maybe examples of both. We can start with Stefan, just so the listeners can relate a bit to the different ideas here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you can use the same technology for good or bad in the sense of, if we take the example of like computer vision, right? Which is the technology that a computer or a system is able to see, maybe quotation marks, which can be used for something like very useful, like Face ID on your phone, right? Unlocking a phone, very convenient thing. It can be used in the medical sense, detecting any kind of skin diseases. There is a great potential in that. But the same technology is also used for facial recognition of surveillance systems. So if you see like the social credit system in China, or also other systems. So the question of good or bad is not necessarily in the technology, but it's like how it's used. So the same goes with, autonomous driving, something that can be very useful. You can, maybe get them like a better traffic flow, maybe even reduce kind of like a carbon dioxide footprint. But also autonomous driving could mean that it's like runs over people, right? Mm. So it's, yeah.
Yeah, and we also see this dual use problem within, for example, like GPS system, artificial, you know, that a car can go from one from point A to point B through the use of artificial intelligence, like using maps and stuff. But then within warfare, you can use it for missiles, you know, to guide to certain targets. And especially, I mean, what's perhaps the most horrific use, I would say, today is the development of autonomous war machines, artificially intelligent autonomous war machines, which can be used to, in war to kill people. But they're basically robots, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and there's, you know, they don't have to be specific, like robotics, like a robot, but it can be the systems that sort of govern different types of applications within the military sphere. So this is the good and bad of AI. I mean, it can be used very much for good and very much for bad. Mm.
So just to follow up on that, because there's been a lot of Hollywood movies with machines suddenly becoming aware of their position and rebelling against the human. Should we be more worried about AI then, or the imagination of the human that uses the AI in this context?
Well, when it comes to awareness, right, there are different takes on this, of course. Some would argue that machines can never become aware because it demands sort of a biological sort of a biological brain and as well as some sort of interaction with a chaotic outside world in order to sort of gain consciousness. Mm. While other argue that there's no sort of there is a possibility that the robots can become consciousness or conscious, develop an artificial consciousness. We're not there yet, but it also has to do a lot with how we define, and this is where it becomes philosophical, right? This is how do we define consciousness? Mm. How do we define, and that also relates to how we define intelligence, right? Is intelligence something that only humans can possess? If that is so, then there's no point in talking about artificial intelligence, right? So there's... I would say that there's also, when we come into this sort of philosophical stuff, there's a lot of conceptual confusion about what is what. Coming back to what you said with Hollywood movies, I think that perhaps that's not the perfect frame of reference when we're going to decide what AI is going to do in our society.
Okay, so if we then look at how AI has impacted your field of work, maybe you can elaborate a bit on that for our listeners, how the bread and butter mechanics of academia and within the industry is impacted by this AI and this influx of maybe automatization or critical thinking, as education and critical thinking become obsolete now that you can just type orders into a machine and it will do the brunt of the work for you. We can start with Stefan.
Well, I guess, I mean, I don't have so much of an educational perspective on that, I guess just because of my more industry background. But one thing in terms of like influx, what I have seen, and that's even before I started like my PhD research on the topic, is that AI has become kind of like a necessity. And maybe one thing we should have clarified earlier is that kind of like AI is an umbrella term basically encompassing like a lot of different technologies, right? And you have this in all the different areas of products or services and software, all of a sudden everything is AI. Just for a couple of days ago when Google did their last I.O., a big presentation about their latest developments, people have made videos about all the time the CEO of Google said AI, and it's basically just like 1.5 minutes AI, AI, AI. Everything is AI right now. Mm. But it also means there is kind of like this push that, okay, everything has to be AI, so also it gets implemented into things that are maybe not necessarily relevant or necessary. And again, that's something I guess we will talk about later, but the question of necessity is something that I think should be asked more often, also in industry. Do we really need kind of like the AI system here, calling it AI, or does it even provide any additional benefit? Mm. And I think maybe it has been too much influx in terms of like the request for presence, like being mentioned or being called AI. So that's, yeah, I guess I'm my industry take on that.
Mm. And how does it impact the industry of academia?
I mean, it's hard to say. It's still early stage, of course. But I feel like the advent of ChatGPT in late November last year sort of it made the AI issue in academia very pertinent and it made a very strong impact. And for me, I've been not been studying it for a long time, but since 2019, I mean, it also made the debate a bit more critical, right? Because people became a bit more hesitant towards it because they saw the power in ChatGPT. It sort of we started asking also the critical questions. So in that sense, there has been a hype around AI saying that it can solve a lot of problems before. But now we're also faced with the negative side that we see, perhaps the impact on student reading, when you can sort of just take an article, ask OpenAI to summarize it for you, and you just read a paragraph instead of 20 pages. Why should you read the 20 pages, right? So how it can impact not just student reading, but also academic reading. I mean, we are always questioned to read a lot more papers than we can. Mm. And that some people might see this as an effective way of combing through a large swathes of research. So there is this double-edged sword here within academia, and I would say, which is caused a lot by especially ChatGPT. Also in terms of what we discussed yesterday at Eilert Salon, in terms of grading, in terms of cheating, right? Students cheating on their exams and how that impacts the way we make exams at the university. Mm. So, there's a huge impact. And it's still an uncertainty. It's still a question to be addressed.
All right. We'll jump on to the next segment in our talk. It's more about, the political dimensions of the use of AI. So, It's quite obvious from our talk already that there is sort of a political awareness now of AI, that it's there's been a change in discourse. To my own understanding, it's very similar to when people talk about the climate. It's something people have to acknowledge one way or another instead of it being more of a talk in the back room. Now it's center stage whenever there is a political gathering. So the first talk we can have is more about whether we should value technological progress when it comes at the expense of the rights of the individual and the collective. So what I mean here is that you have, especially in administration, some an infield of AI that takes over different processes where normally there would be a person making a decision if you apply for unemployment benefits or if you are applying to have a surgery done. There will be different steps of AI that's incorporated that, while it's convenient, also can make mistakes. And if that mistakes happen, who's accountable then? Is it the program? So there's a dimension there of the rights of the individual that they cannot hold people accountable. So what is your take on this? Is it a fair discussion to have that we should be able to demand to have some kind of human interaction when we are doing our daily chores when it comes to public services? And we can start with the expert.
Well, I think that's probably like a very relevant question that needs to be asked right now. And it's basically exactly one of my research topics to look at the use of AI in public services. And I think, well, we did studies with like citizens, but also with like caseworkers from organizations, and like learning more about their attitudes and their understandings of systems. And you could feel on both sides that the notion of having basically a human as the ultimate power of decision is still a requirement, which basically aligns with everything that any, let's say, human-centered AI research also suggests, to say, understand those type of technology more as augmentation of a human capacity rather than a replacement. And I think that's probably the same, or it's also true for the public service, that you can have processes more efficient, maybe you can automate certain parts of it, but there still needs to be this entity of control. And I think that's kind of the expectation on the side of the citizen, to say, well, I want to be able to talk to someone, I want to contest the result, I want to have this human touch, as some people were calling it. And then the same side on the actual caseworker or employee of the organization, saying, I can trust the system maybe, but I want still to be like the overruling power if necessary, because I think I know the case maybe better than the machine. And I think there's also kind of a notion of obligation towards the citizen, and saying, well, I'm a public servant, so I need to do the best, and maybe I can do it better than a machine.
Yes. Yeah, I think this is a super relevant, super interesting questions, and there's a lot of things to be said about it. I mean, the public administration as we know it today stems from Max Weber a lot, that, you know, public servants should be meritocratically chosen, chosen because of their, you know, their knowledge of a situation. They should not be corrupt. They should not be non-biased when they're making decisions. And this is sort of the same that we would measure AI systems the same way that we measure, you know, humans in that sense. We would ask the same questions to them. However, it poses a sort of dilemma here for policymakers, because there's one article which is called Algorithm versus Algorithm, published in the US in 2021 by a person named Kari Koglianias. And he says that he also takes up, there's a lot of human biases existing today, right? So we look, for example, at judges in the US. We see that they make, as they sit until, you know, they basically pass away, right? They become less efficient and make less favorable judgments towards people towards the end of their career. We can see that, like studying that. We can also see that judges later in the day will make less favorable judgments towards citizens because it's late, because they're tired, because they've had like 10, 20, 30 cases already. So this is, and this is what Koglianias means here with algorithm versus algorithm, that we can't really see us humans as non-biased because we're already biased. And this poses an interesting dilemma here for the public administration. Also, when we talk about human in the loop, like you said, like, yeah, we can implement an AI, but then we would need some human to sort of control it. How do we know that this human controls it good? How do we know when it spots the mistakes that the AI does and doesn't interfere when it's not doing mistakes? Mm. I mean, it's and this is why I think this is part of a different discussion about public services, about public administration in general, and the dilemmas of decision making So there's no clear answer here. But it's sort of the implementation of the technology sparks this discussion, right? That we need to have, that we are having.
Well, no, maybe just to add to this, with kind of the bias question is, I guess, something we had, or I think a lot of arguments are made about that this a system might be, like an AI system might be like less biased in one way or the other, which is already kind of the flawed assumption, because those systems are trained on data and data will be biased in a way, and it's very difficult to like clean that data. I mean, we have prominent examples about like the Amazon recruiting case where all of a sudden the system disregarded women because the pattern in the data showed that Amazon recruiters usually kind of preferred male applicants, right? So there's, you basically have both, or like biased entities on both sides of the equation. So that's a very relevant point about who's actually like the entity that decides what is right and what is wrong.
And to follow up on that, you research a lot about human-centered AI. Is it fair that we as citizens can expect whether it's public officials or those in the industry to actually have a clue about technology, since it's outsourced right now as sort of a tool? I mean, they are not the developers who have a finger on the pulse. Is it fair to expect that they actually know what goes beyond in, or what goes on in the algorithm once they press the enter button?
Yeah. Well, as we said in the beginning, I mean, it's even hard for us who are like working and studying on that topic to keep up with things. So I would not expect anyone from the public administration to have a full understanding. But I don't think that's really necessary. But a basic understanding is something I would like to see. Every time you see those kind of like Congress hearings of like the Congress people asking tech CEOs of Facebook or TikTok, and just the kind of questions they ask makes you very aware that there is a huge lack of understanding how technology works. And I think somewhere in between it would be nice. So like a basic understanding could be very, very helpful just for the sake of having a conversation, just to speaking the same language.
Yeah, so following up on that also, and we can hear Francis' take on that, is there a bigger philosophy behind the introduction of AI? Is it about elevating humankind, or is it about cutting costs, making profits? What is your insight on this? Is there some kind of bigger agenda, or is it, like you say, more about creating a profit and disrupting the market, so to say, like we've seen with some programs already?
I mean, that's a very interesting question, and it's something that sort of bothered me across the work of my PhD. I mean, we can see from 2016 and onwards, you know, when DeepMind made this, they beat the world champion in Go. Lee Sedol, where that, you know, their AI bot beat this world champion in a very, very, very extremely complex game, which no one thought they would ever do. But after that, we can see that after 2016, there were a lot of policymakers taking this into account, right? So you had the G20, the G7, the EU came along quite early in the game in 2018. We have the OECD. And after the EU started to make their policy, a lot of they said that, you know, we need the member states to make their own policies, and then the member states in the EU made their own policies. And I think that in a sense, these policies, and they've garnered critique also because they have seen this was before ChatGPT, right? So so the debate around AI was more about the possibilities, right? The debate around AI was more about how it can enhance, how it can improve, how it can make more efficient, how it can, you know, contribute to competitiveness and this and that. And this, there's a lot of scholars, or not a lot, but there are some scholars today that address this and say that the policies that were implemented in the late 2010s did not really consider the risks politically, did not really consider the overall philosophy of this. It more saw AI as just a force multiplier for good, to make public administration more efficient, to make public sector organizations more efficient and modern and effective. So I would say that I'm hesitant to call it sort of an ideology, but I still think that there is perhaps a bias in within the public debate to see AI being this sort of disruptive force that makes our society better, when it might not do that, right? It depends on how we use it. And we still need to ask these questions about what values to pursue. I mean, is it more competitive companies that we need right now? Is that, do we need more competitive nations? Like, what do we need? And that sort of questions is not really talked about. So there's a lot of values underlying these policies that I think that we need to address.
Okay, so to follow up on that, I have a twofold question then. Is there more, say, ambitious legislation on the way? Now you see it's almost day by day that something new is happening. And also, has AI reached its full potential? Do you start to see counter movements of people who are feeling that now it's taking over too much? Again, the example of public administration and other, that's people also trying to work against the development now. We can start with Stefan and hear your take.
Sure. Well, in terms of counter movements, I'm not sure if I would call it a counter movement, but there definitely have been an increase in raised concerns. And you have, like, as I said before, you have people who are well known in the field and probably considered domain experts, raising concerns and being worried about where this is going, not necessarily saying, okay, we should, I don't know, move back at some point, but just like maybe a reconsideration, maybe kind of, slowing things down in a way, because there are good arguments for like not just pulling through by any means necessary. And in terms of ambitious legislation, I think the EU actually is a very great case for that. Because compared to other regions in the world, I think the EU does a decent job in actually addressing these topics. Just yesterday, we had kind of like the next step for the EU AI Act being kind of like moved forward. And there is a lot of useful debate already happening there. We have the AI high-level experts group on the European Commission side. We have those trustworthy AI guidelines that are being published. We have this risk-based approach, which helps to basically just kind of like put some understanding about an impact of a system. So I think the EU is a very kind of like trailblazer, if you will, on that front.
Is that also your perception, Franz?
Yes. Yes and no. I mean, the AI Act is, I mean, the EU, like I said, they caught on quite early, started in 2018 with making policy. And, you know, you have the high level expert group and, you know, the alt AI, the principles, the risk based approach, all of this. I mean, and the AI Act, and it's going to be really interesting to see now in June how it will, you know, play out in the European Parliament when they're going to actually vote about this. But it seems that there is a consensus around the AI Act. And it also seems that the suggestion is more, is harder than what the Commission proposed initially,
okay,
right? So that there, I don't know exactly why, but there has been, you know, concerns of, you know, there are some digital rights groups in the EU, you know, they work, you know, with the lobby system and all of that. So there are concerns raised here, and there's a law coming. And then again, yeah, we will see what will happen with GDPR. We saw that a lot of the world actually followed the EU legislation. Then again, okay, so what did the GDPR help us with? Like, the only thing that we do is we click accept cookies as soon as we enter a new web page, which we haven't visited. But, I mean, there are things to be done here. Then, you know, you could also, I mean, we should also remember that the EU is born of a sort of a idea around the single market. The single market is the strongest sort of institution within the EU. And therefore, the high-level expert group consisted of a majority of industry representatives. There were two ethicists that left the group because they felt the high-level expert group of the EU was taken over by corporate interests. And when we have the single market as the sort of the factor that ties the union together, we would expect laws which suggests market-based solutions to these problems. Of course, there will be some prohibitions like facial recognition and this and that, but we can also expect sort of a legislation which addresses and sort of promotes AI for commercial, the different forms of commercial use.
Yeah, so just to follow up on that, now you mentioned there's diverging end goals, so to say, between the industry and the ethics. What direction are times heading towards? Do you see that the EU will become more or introduce more regulation to follow up on the GDPR track there on, or will they become more or less fair in order to compete with the US and China and other big actors? What is your take? We can maybe start with Stefan and hear his take on it.
Well, I guess personally, I definitely see the need for any type of like stronger regulation. And maybe just quickly following up on the GDPR case, because you said for like all we do is like click on accept cookies. In one of my previous companies, where the person who was responsible for the implementation of the GDPR guidelines was also the CTO, and he was like, let's very blunt when it came to GDPR. So he basically, when let's say the marketing team or I don't know the sales team discussed some kind of like ideas to do, if something kind of went against the GDPR guidelines, he basically said, okay, this will cost us X thousand euros, we are not going to do this. So that there is an awareness inside companies that if you basically breach GDPR rules, then you are in big trouble. So, and it might sound harsh and you will hear the argument about stifling innovation, and but I think it's a necessary it's a necessary tool. So I think if the GDPR can serve as a good example in a way. So yeah, I'm personally actually would like to see a bit of a maybe stronger regulation, but at the same time, like having the necessary conversations before that. So what does like a good regulation actually mean? So I guess that's probably what we need to talk about first.
Yes.
Yeah. So and I agree. You point out some. I mean, of course, we're better off with GDPR than, you know, but if we're talking about sort of the dominance of the big tech companies, then the GDPR is not helping, right? And that is something that we all are concerned about. We're sort of being data mined to death, like this kind of. So there are some things here which the legislation does not sort of address. And there are some inequalities within these emerging markets, which will continue to sort of be an issue moving forward. But I still think that, you know, some of the court cases of Margrethe Vestager, when she took Facebook and Google to court and fined them a lot. I mean, this is something that happened in the EU. And it's a, I mean, the recognition of the sort of oligopolistic tendencies of these companies are being recognized within this sort of circles, and that is something that we need to sort of address also.
So does this mean that we should view the EU as a power factor in this global technological race? Maybe in broad strokes you can paint the picture for us. How is the world situation right now? Who's the important players? And maybe we can start with Stefan.
Sure. Well, of course, I guess the main players that you currently have in the discussions are companies, usually from the US or China, with companies like Google, Amazon, Facebook, or Meta, and Apple. But I think personally, again, the EU takes probably the healthier and like the more, I'm not sure if I would call it like the safer approach, but I mean, the situation that we currently have, especially with like ChatGPT and every related like large language models, is that since Microsoft has invested into OpenAI and basically kind of enforced, making this public, which basically enforced every other company to do a similar thing and without putting like the appropriate guardrails in. And the same things could probably also happen like in China. And I think, or I would hope that the EU might be there more like a kind of like a sane player in that conversation. So I think that, the EU definitely should have its say there.
Yeah, at the Eilish Salon yesterday, we talked a little bit about the grown up in the room, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe that's how we can conceptualize EU here, that, we should take this trustworthy, risk-based approach. This is how we need to approach these novel technologies and this and that. Because, it seems that, China and the US are, of course, perhaps the most, aggressive of the global players at the moment, with Silicon Valley and, Shenzhen, and the sort of concentration of power around this central administration in China, that they don't need to sort of consider, let's say, Western rights in the same, they don't need to consider data privacy in the same way, so they can use it a lot more freely, right? Their data. And I mean, the EU tries to sort of shape, or in the way that I see it, is that the EU tries to shape this, what you say, the sane approach. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to sort of become this global player of the, sort of trustworthy sort of player within AI, that we're not like the US, we're not like China, we're something different. So they're trying to sort of shape their identity here, in a sense. And that's something that we need to see. It's only just emerging, and we have to see the consequences of this. Mm. And if a lot of, it will be the same thing with GDPR, that a lot of the countries around the world will adopt similar laws, then the AI Act, if that happens with the AI Act, then the EU is sort of becomes this sort of global policy, maybe the China and the US has the technological advantage, but the policy advantage is at the EU level, right? That the or with the EU, so they have some sort of leverage there, and some sort of a role to play in the global.
So, do you see any tech alliances emerging, or is it a free for all where everyone is sort of fighting against each other? Here, I'm especially thinking of the CHIPS Act in the US that restricted the access to microchips, that disrupted the whole supply chain that was otherwise very globally centered. Like something was produced in China, and other parts were developed in the US or the EU. Do you see that the states will enact more of this kind of protectionism, that they will distance themselves from each other, even the US and the EU becoming rivals, at least in the tech and the AI scene, that there's no warm feelings towards each other? We can start with Franz.
Yeah, I mean, since the illegal and aggressive, you know, invasion of Ukraine by Russia, we see that in all sectors, I would say. We see that the weaponization of, you know, of oil, the weaponization of energy. And it's the same thing in the Taiwan, US-China conflict, right? Mm. And this has been for a while. Mm. And there are, I'm not an international relations scholar. I need to point that out. So I'm not really, you know, this is not my field. But there is, of course, some underlying sort of power. You can conceptualize it from that way, that there are underlying power sort of mechanisms at work here, especially within the chips industry. Mm. But more than that, you know, what to sort of see the outlook, it's highly uncertain, but we know that, you know, these things become weaponized, especially in times of conflict, right? Mm.
Yeah, I guess not sure if there's much to add to that. I fully agree. And I guess it's probably a sad thing to see that this kind of like separation actually happens. Because, I mean, we're talking about, as you, Johannes, you mentioned at the beginning, we're having like global crises, right? And that are basically affecting everyone. So any kind of like separation in that sense is probably very counterproductive. But it's true. It is happening, and we can see that in many areas. But it's it's a sad thing to say to see, actually.
Mm. So to conclude our discussion today, I'll pose the question: what do you think the future holds for AI and the EU? And here you have the privilege of coming with maybe both a positive and a pessimistic viewpoint. How do you see, as experts, that the times will develop?
Okay. I'm to be honest, I'm very hesitant to make any kind of predictions about the future, because I mean, so many people have been proven wrong with any type of outlooks or like ideas. So if we're looking for like an optimistic outlook, I would hope for like having these conversations. And I said, I think it would have been already the time to have these conversations, and a lot of these conversations are already happening, especially I guess in the EU or on the EU level. I would like to have these like expand globally, and yeah, moving forward, raising the awareness about the issues that exist, but also like the potential.
I mean, I agree with Stefan. There's so many takes, like everyone has a hot take, and AI is such a multidisciplinary area. It almost seems like there's, you know, everyone competes with the best take. Yeah, what's going to happen? You know, what's the best bet? But I want to say more that we don't know the outcome of this AI spring or AI summer, what we're within right now. Mm. But we can say that there are some things that will not happen. Mm. I mean, there's a lot of, for example, when the internet came, it was 20 years ago. Everyone thought that this would revolutionize the democratic sphere and the public sphere, and everyone was supposed to sort of exchange views, and it would be like this huge, you know, global democratic, you know, public square. 20 years later, did that happen? Not really, right? So what we're struggling with today, and what we have been struggling with as societies, inequality, poverty, hunger, the destruction of our planet, these sort of deep-seated, we can say, dilemmas that we're facing today as a society, we will also face tomorrow, but with a different take. Mm. And
I therefore am a bit hesitant to see AI, just specifically AI or generally, as sort of a force multiplier for the better society. Mm. In that sense, I am a bit, you know, I think that it has its uses. Of course, I do that. But overall, I think that we need to ask ourselves the bigger questions, like the what kind of society questions that, around AI a bit more. Mm. I guess that's my 5 cents.
Yes, and at least for now, that's a discussion that the AI can't solve for us, what kind of society we want to develop. On that note, thank you to the both of you for participating. And also thank you to the listener for listening in on this podcast episode. I hope that this has been an informative experience. This podcast series has been realized with support and funding from the University of Agder and the European Erasmus Plus program. Thank you.